It's philosophy talk.
We have to extricate the truth from this unbeliever on pain of torture.
Waterboarding.
The Iron Maiden.
The Rack.
The Thumbscrew.
Fetch me the soft cushions.
Is it right to torture to save a life?
10 lives.
1,000,000 lives?
Civilization as a whole.
Now, infidel, confess!
Sometimes I feel. Sometimes I feel. Back out the car to the ripping road. But Lord, I feel like I'm dying.
Isn't it always wrong to torture?
Our guest is Nancy Sherman from Georgetown University.
Get the comfy chair!
The ethics of torture.
Confess! Confess!
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
We hope you enjoy this episode of Philosophy Talk.
Stay up to date with the program and receive our monthly e-newsletter by texting philosophy to 22828. That's 22828.
And to become a partner in our community of thinkers, visit philosophytalk.org.
Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Today, the ethics of torture.
Ken, in a recent past, there was a lot of discussion about whether waterboarding counts as torture. Are we going to use our subtle, well-trained philosophical minds to think about waterboarding for an entire hour?
Gosh, John, I sure hope not. I mean, look, almost every dictionary gives two definitions of torture, a narrow one that includes inflicting great physical pain, and a broader, more inclusive one that includes inflicting severe mental anxiety and suffering. Waterboarding clearly counts as torture by the second definition, so there's no issue, even if it's ambiguous whether it counts as torture by the first definition. And since our topic is the ethics or morality of torture, for that purpose, we need to think about the more inclusive definition that includes inflicting severe mental anxiety and mental suffering.
Well, let's start with a moral point of view that seems to offer a pretty unambiguous answer. That's Kant's. Kant said you should never treat people merely as instruments, never just as a means to your own goals. Humans, he says, are autonomous beings. Each of us has our own goals. There's a difference between a tape recorder and a person. I'm not sure that's Kant's example. If you're having trouble getting information out of a tape recorder, you can pound on it or kick it. That may not be very effective, but it isn't immoral, at least not if you own the tape recorder. But if you want to get information out of a person, you should connect your desire for information with their goals. You should rationally convince them to tell you what you want to know.
John, that sounds all very high-minded and noble, but you know, it doesn't sound very practical. Fortunately, there are other moral points of view that give us an alternative to this. Take a pure utilitarian. A pure utilitarian says that an act is right if it brings about the greatest good for the greatest number. Now, if someone has kidnapped a child and left them to die somewhere, and you need to find out where, and torturing someone until they talk is the only way you're going to find out where, it might just be the right thing to do to torture the person. Look, it'll be better for the child, better for the parents, even better for the criminal, because it'll prevent a murder charge. And murder plus kidnapping is certainly worse than kidnapping alone. Or take a terror. If you torture a terrorist and uncover a plot that saves thousands and thousands of lives, how could that possibly be wrong?
Well, so we got two clear positions. You're thinking of act utilitarians, but there's a kind of a between position between act utilitarianism and Kantianism, rule utilitarianism. Rule utilitarians say that we should adopt rules that, if followed, will bring about the greatest good for the greatest number. Not torturing could well be such a rule. If we don't have a firm rule against torture, torture might not be limited to cases of kidnapping and terrorism. So even from a sort of utilitarian point of view, a ban on torture may be justified.
Well, I take your point, but if we're going to get into rule-mongering, sure, the rule should be don't torture except in extreme circumstances. Look, imagine, just imagine being the parent of a kidnapped child. Or imagine losing a member of your family to a terrorist who blows up a building or is about to blow up a building. You'd be pretty angry if you found out after the fact that Kiefer Sutherland could have gotten the information to save their lives if he had just not been so delicate and engaged in a little bit of torture.
Kiefer Sutherland. You mean the character he plays, Jack Bauer.
Right, the hero on 24, that TV show. He tortures several people per episode to foil terrorist plots. And most viewers seem to think he's doing the right thing.
Well, that's a good argument, Ken. A good argument that TV watchers must be utilitarians, not Kantians. But, you know, there are some other, perhaps deeper issues we should discuss, too. Right or wrong, torture happens. Is it effective? Sometimes soldiers, perhaps even American soldiers, are ordered or encouraged to engage in torture. Does it destroy your character to torture someone? What's, so to speak, the phenomenology of torturing and of being tortured? What's it like to torture someone or to be tortured?
We have a lot to discuss, clearly, and our guest today is Nancy Sherman from Georgetown University. She's thought long and hard about torture and related topics.
And we know you've thought about it, too. So join us by calling 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. And you can send an email to comments@philosophytalk.org.
But first, our roving philosophical reporter, Jill Ruppligo, examines the torturer's point of view. How do soldiers who participate in torture feel about their role? She files this report.
Chris Arndt was 17 when he enlisted in the National Guard. At age 19, he was at Guantanamo Bay guarding prisoners.
I was responsible for all the keys and the shackle keys and the locks, the padlocks and the shackles, and I organized the escort teams that moved the detainees throughout the camp.
He also took shifts manning the prison gates, walking up and down cell blocks, and monitoring interrogations. He says there's no question that prisoners were abused.
There was physical abuse on the behalf of the guards. I witnessed a lot of that myself, and there was also the abuse of keeping people awake for several months at a time, keeping them from sleeping for large periods of time by moving them. That was called the frequent flyer program. And as an escort controller, I was in charge of making sure that detainees are moved frequently from one cell to the other.
Arndt says he never saw any waterboarding or anything like that, but he considers himself a torturer.
You know, I helped make Guantanamo Bay work, and Guantanamo Bay is a place where torture, I do believe, does happen on a daily basis, and I'm absolutely 100% guilty of participating in torture.
At the time, though, this didn't register.
I mean, a place like Guantanamo is so consistently intense that over the course of a year, everything just kind of bleeds together. I emotionally tuned out pretty quickly, like everybody else in my unit.
Arndt is one of four U.S. soldiers featured in a book written by San Francisco journalist Justine Sherrick. She wanted to find out how being involved in torture had affected these soldiers and how their communities back home reacted to them. She thought people would be appalled.
But I found the exact opposite, where it was the people back home who had the highest level of support for torture, and the soldiers were the ones that felt guilt and felt like they had to hide that from their communities that wanted to celebrate them as war heroes.
Besides feeling guilty, she found that many of the soldiers were outraged, partially because they didn't always realize they were participating in abuse until later.
Because a lot of the so-called torture light, the things like sleep deprivation or stress positions, especially at Guantanamo, are done in a way that, like various cogs in the machine, so each individual soldier doesn't necessarily see the larger picture of what they're doing.
Like Chris Arndt and the frequent flyer program, now that the Bush administration's policy on detainee handling is being heavily questioned, some of the veterans feel deceived.
They were just told the Geneva Conventions don't apply, but then when they realized that those arguments were faulty, then it just added an extra sense of betrayal.
Sherrick said it was hard to ask soldiers outright whether they considered themselves torturers.
I was surprised by how difficult it was for me to ask that question, because it would even be after 20 hours of interviews talking in detail about what they did, but then actually saying the word torture. One soldier, Andrew Duffy, said, "Of course I wouldn't call myself a torturer. Who wants to apply that label to themselves?" Which is sort of the most sort of honest and basic way to put it.
She found the definition of torture is murky in ways we don't usually think about.
Often the most violent and sort of bloody acts aren't necessarily torture. Something like leaving someone in a restraint chair for days without food or water versus beating someone up. That can even just be seen as an act of aggression.
Arndt, the guy who guarded prisoners at Guantanamo, says there's no sharp line between what is and is not torture. But if you're doing it, you just know.
If you're dealing in any way, shape, or form in a way in which one begins to question oneself about whether or not things are torture, you're probably torturing somebody, and there's no justification for doing that, in my mind, at all, when there was no safeguard whatsoever to ensure that we were not doing this to innocent people.
Chris Arndt now works with a group called Iraq Veterans Against the War. He's been writing and speaking publicly about his experiences. Justine Sherrick's book, Tortured, comes out in summer 2010. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Jill Replogle.
I'm John Perry, and with me is Ken Taylor.
And our guest is Nancy Sherman. She's a professor of philosophy from Georgetown University. She's author of The Untold War, Inside the Hearts, Minds, and Souls of Our Soldiers. Nancy, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi there, John and Ken.
Tell me just briefly, how did you get interested in this particular subject, in the military mind and the philosophical aspects of being a warrior?
Mid-90s, I found myself at the Naval Academy, and a year or two later, I found myself as the distinguished chair in ethics there. They had a cheating scandal, which sometimes brings ethics to their campus, and and moral philosophers, ethicists like ourselves. And I got there and started teaching ethics, and I found that one of the segments of my, the sections of my course that most resonated had to do with stoicism, sucking it up, essentially being tough. And so I started thinking about the military mind, both in terms of traditional stoic ethos, which is a military model, whether they know it as the ancient stoicism or not, and in general, the kind of moral psyche that is required to be soldiering. And I found in thinking about this that there's a real moral hole in thinking about the interior landscape of soldiering, and not just the external battlefield or the rule of law or the laws of war.
Okay, before we get into some of the more deeper issues, let's just exploit the fact that you've been thinking about this for a long time. I want to ask you two things. What's your working definition of torture, and do you agree with Chris Arndt in the interview with the Roving Philosophical Reporter that there's no clear line between where interrogation leaves off and torture begins? And so what kind of line is there if there's no clear line?
Well, let me begin with the last question. I don't think there is a clear line. However, I do think that we need to be much more cognizant that that there are appropriate methods of interrogation that still may feel make interrogators feel morally queasy, various forms of exploitation, which I'll talk about in a moment. That said, there are certainly no clear lines between torture light and torture. I'm not one to begin to quantify exactly how much sleep deprivation counts as torture, how much sensory deprivation, how much loud noise, what kind of music, the nature of waterboarding, which, by the way, is an old cure called the water cure, used in by the Americans during the Philippine War, Spanish-American War, excuse me. So I agree with your opening segment. Mental torture, psychological anguish that comes with certain kinds of violations of the self, as well as physical torture, both are tortures. The line drawn between light and heavy seems to me to require quantification that I'm certainly not about to make.
Well, I want to jump in here. So, okay, there's not a clear line. There are some clear cases, though, of torture and non-torture. I want you to frame the question of what torture is in a way that helps us think about why torture is wrong, if it's wrong, and when it's wrong, right? I mean, why exactly? Because if we cause somebody pain, is it always wrong to cause people pain? Well, I don't know. Maybe. Maybe not. Is it always wrong to cause people anguish? Maybe. Maybe not. I'm not sure. But help me frame the question in a way that helps me think, why is it wrong and what exactly is wrong about it, if you can do that briefly.
Interrogation in general, for the purposes of, obviously, of getting information, involves exploiting individuals, using them, making them abject, and then making them dependent on you. Now, that's what good interrogators do. It seems to violate the dignity of a human being, if you're looking at Kant, but only in a but within certain limits. When you move to torture, there is a severe violation of the dignity of a human being in a way that may not allow that human being to recover themselves. So some of it has to do with recovery. But I would actually argue that the kinds of violations that move from the good exploitation and interrogation to the horrible torture that goes on in 24, Jack Bauer style, et cetera, and in the cases that we saw in Abu Ghraib and in Guantanamo, are on a continuum. But the point at the continuum is hard to draw.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're discussing the ethics of torture with Nancy Sherman, author of The Untold War, Inside the Hearts, Minds, and Souls of Our Soldiers.
In our next segment, we're going to discuss the effects of torture on the person tortured and on the torturer. And when, if ever, it's moral to torture someone. We'd like to know what you think. Is torture ever justified? Is it effective? Have you ever been tortured? Have you ever been required to engage in torture? You can join us by calling 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. You can also email your comments to comments@philosophytalk.org.
The psychology and morality of torture, plus your calls and emails, untortured, we hope, when Philosophy Talk continues.
So, is torture any less cruel and unusual now than it was in the Middle Ages? What are the ethics of torture? I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor, and this is Philosophy Talk. And what do you think? Is torture ever the right thing to do? Is it effective? Have you ever been tortured or been forced to be a torturer? Or willingly chose to torture? The number is 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. And last but not least, we've got a blog discussion already started. Feel free to weigh in on our blog and share your comments with the world. Our guest is Nancy Sherman, author of The Untold War, Inside the Hearts, Minds, and Souls of Our Soldiers.
And we're getting emails and calls already, and a lot of people are interested in what seems to be a preliminary question. Does torture work? Paul in San Francisco writes, it seems to me that the most important question for justifying torture is, do we know that torture works? We can only justify torture if it works. And Ken, I think, has a caller with a similar point.
We have a caller in the line, Steve from San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Steve. What's your comment or question?
Well, as you mentioned earlier, briefly, during the Middle Ages, horrific torture was used to extract the most ridiculous confessions from people supposedly being witches and devils and so on. So the basic line there is that torture, they can make you say anything they want. So from that point of view, basically even that, just from that, the information extraction, may be irrelevant or may be wrong, you know. So it's not a very good source of information.
Right. Thanks for the call, Steve. So Nancy, these two comments, they raise, I think, both a sort of practical question of whether torture even works. But it can work in one way, and it's to the detriment of the torturer that the will of the tortured becomes so debased that he'll tell you anything just to stop the torturer. He'll be an instrument of your telling you what you want to hear. Comment on any aspect of that you'd like.
Yeah, I think that's right. I don't think there's there's no strong evidence that the consequentialist or utilitarian argument you outlined earlier actually produces the intelligence. The pain is so great that you get a person into a really compromised mode to do anything, say anything, to appease the pain. And also there's transference effect, as they would say in psychoanalysis. Often these folks become so dependent that they really want to please the person who is interrogating them, and again will say something simply as a way of kind of relating to the person and also pleasing them and getting them to stop. Also, we know that intelligence is primarily about putting the pieces together. It's about the hard work of dotting all the I's, crossing the T's, as we've learned in the past few months.
But back up for a second. Suppose I'm a torturer and I'm morally obtuse and I want to keep this as an instrument. And I know that people can become so dependent and debased that they'll tell me what I want to hear. I don't want to be in the position of them just telling. Are there I don't know if you want to give advice to would-be torturers, but is there any way for the torturer? Is this an inescapable problem for the torturer? Is there any way to convince yourself that the subject isn't just trying to satisfy me and make me happy, but is telling me what I really want to know, the truth about, you know, the enemy or the this, that, or the other thing?
Well, there's lots of modes for self-deception. When I've talked to folks that have been interrogators, they tell me how great the temptation and pressure is to torture, largely because of their own anger and rage and frustration. They've been sitting with someone for months on end, 8 hours a day. They can't get them to move. They can't get them to talk. Or they, in one case, one of my interviewees had seen a woman aviator, shot down, and saw the pictures afterwards, which were horrific. And he said his own sexism kind of started to rise, that he had payback feelings, revenge. And he knew that he thought, you know, well, the person I'm talking to can pay in a certain way, or maybe they have information in future cases that I can prevent. And, you know, this kid had enough sensibility in his mind and ability to switch out of his frustrated interrogator role to hold back and put the restraints on himself, realizing in all his cases that it wasn't going to be the way to get the info.
So Nancy, I want to segue in here to about philosophy. Now, we had a colleague at Stanford, James Stockdale, and he also figures in your book, who was prisoner of war in Vietnam and was badly tortured for a very long period of time. I think he was the longest prisoner there. And he,
7.5 years.
Yeah, yeah. He taught a course for us in the philosophy department where he emphasized, he had the students read Epictetus, and he emphasized that the philosophy of Stoicism, and particularly Epictetus, had really helped him cope with it. So my question is, are there certain philosophical points of view that are good for the torturee, and how about for the torturer?
Stockdale is someone I know, whose work I know fairly well. I interviewed him myself a few times, and he is a hero in the naval community, military community in general. Yeah, he had been handed the handbook, Epictetus's Enchiridion, or handbook, and memorized it, and it became his consolation and working philosophy as the head of the chain of command at the Hanoi Hilton. And I think it did work well. He told his boys, so to speak, to take torture only for the things that, you know, to decide what they were going to take torture for, and also to have as much control as they could over their lives, and to sort of draw their agency tight so that they didn't feel that they were being instruments or victims. On the other hand, he knew where the limits were. He said, there are no virgins here. Some of us are going to break, and some of us are going to feel like we're betraying each other. And you have to know that there are lines. We're humans, and we have some vulnerability.
So Stoicism tells you there's some things outside of your control and some things within your control, and only worry about the things within your control. One of the things that are outside your control is your body. So if somebody's, like, inflicting great pain on your body, somehow you're supposed to be able to somehow rise above that. I mean, being told that is one thing, but actually implementing that, I don't know if I know how to implement that. Do you know how
well,
to implement
Stoicism, I sure don't, but Stoicism does view the body as an indifferent, in a way, a dispreferred indifference, something that you can say is not part of your rational, is outside your virtue, full virtue. You know, you can do certain things, obviously, to make it better and more cooperative to your rational agency, but ultimately their view is that it's separate from you. That's not a position I support. But what Stockdale was able to learn was that there were strategies for gaining more rather than less control, especially in the situations of deprivation and you know, such that he wasn't fully depraved. And he was in solitary for 2.5 years, and, you know, in a leg iron. So there were, you know, and he did sit-ups every morning. So there were certain things. And that Stoic ethos, I think, is part of a popular view. I'm going to be able to control as much as I can, and I'm going to try to resist the will, or at least identifying with the will of my torturer.
So it's a good, it seems to me, a good point of view. I think Epictetus was a slave, if my Roman
yes, and Stockdale himself identified with him enormously. Same leg went lame. When I have talked to Stockdale, my ear could not pick up the transitions between Epictetus and Stockdale.
Exactly.
So seamless was it.
But how about the person who is in control, the torturer, I think it might be a very dangerous philosophy for them, because they might say, well, you know, I have to do this. It's out of my control. Is the same philosophy that's good for the tortured good for the torturer, or a good thing for the torturer to have?
Good question.
Especially when the torturer is, you know, the foot soldier, not the general, the one who's being somehow required to carry this out.
Well, there are a few worries. One is that, right, you draw the line about what's within your agency and outside your agency in the wrong place. So you become really an instrument of a tool, which has been the whole problem with torture. It's a systemic practice. And those low down, whether they're psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, or lawyers working in the system are still complicit in the system. So, but though they may not feel their agency is fully within their control. Also, you run the risk of it numbing you, and it being a kind of way of detaching also from your emotions. That's one of the things the Stoics say: detach from emotions. Well, you may start detaching from empathy with the detainee who has become so compromised.
And the whole bureaucratic structure of torture, the whole institutionalization of the agencies, of the instruments of torture, are designed to make that easy for you to do. I mean,
that's right. They're designed to morally insulate you, right, and distance you.
That's part of what Hannah Arendt was talking about, I think, when she was talking about the banality of evil. But, you know, we've got lots of callers on the line. 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. And Uwe from El Cerrito is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Uwe. Did I get that name right?
Yeah, roughly. I'm a psychologist, and I direct Survivors International, which is an organization that helps torture victims in San Francisco. And Nancy's cousin, Mark Schaefer, told me I should call in, and I'm going to. So he says hi.
But hi to Mark and to you.
But I'll confine my mini comments to just one, and that is. That, you know, in the entire public discussion about torture, the impression that has been created very deliberately that there is lesser forms of torture, and that the our government uses only lesser forms of torture, is very important in terms of how people think about it and evaluate it morally and ethically. And this is a major deception that has to be pointed out. You know, things like waterboarding, sleep deprivation, and so on are in the first place not mental, but they are very physical techniques, you know, because you have to confine somebody and have to do something to them physically over extended periods of time that are extremely abusive and that, unlike, for instance, a beating, leave very severe lifelong consequences, you know, profound dysregulation of the autonomic nervous system, disorders like post-traumatic stress disorder, where the consequences of these things are so severe that to say, for instance, like you did in your opening statement, that something like waterboarding doesn't really, qualify for the first definition, but the second definition of torture, and, you know, this is the kind of thing that then leads to, well, you know, we're not barbarians, we're not, you know, sort of inflicting physical injury. You know, that is a major misconception that then leads people to evaluate, this very question of what has been done, in the wrong way.
Yeah, you said a lot mouthful there. Thank you for the call. I'm going to get Nancy's response here. Yeah.
Just a few things. The psychological physical distinction is often one that the torturer wants to draw in order to essentially say, if it's merely psychological, there are no scars left behind, and that's in their interest not to leave scars behind. We know a lot about what happened to victims in South Africa, including one I talk about in the book, Untold War, Albie Sachs, who endured a lot. And it was the stuff that hurt the most were the ones that left might not have had scars left behind. Right. So scars are often telltale signs, and it doesn't mean that it's not. It's not torture if there are no scars left behind. So I actually think most physical blends right into psychological. There's no easy distinction,
right?
There.
So and we weren't trying to give the torturer an out by making this distinction. Actually, we said the broader definition is what's really relevant to moral discourse. I mean, so including anxiety and stuff.
Right. And I would also just argue, you know, the torture just isn't just the detainee in a cell with an interrogator. It's also, it could be, I was in Guantanamo in 2005 as part of a medical observer team, looking at psychologists and psychiatrists' role. And then I discovered upon coming back that the folks that were hunger strikers were had put in restraints. And we think, to the best of our information, were given diuretics and laxatives while being force-fed. You know, so they're taking someone beyond their control
in ways that are very, very degrading. Let's get some more callers in here. Ruth in Berkeley's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Ruth.
Okay, thank you. I have a question. I was wondering, since there are people who get off on pretending to be in these dominant submission torture scenarios that are consensual, I was wondering whether these people who are put in position of being torturers are getting some kind of a sexual rush from this. And maybe, and my fear is they'd come back to the community and look for that same sort of thing. It's total dominance, and these people are in a situation where that's their entire life for a while. They're not with any partners or anything. But I was wondering whether they start to enjoy it and get sexual feelings from it too.
Well, thanks. I have some thoughts on that, again, from interrogators. You know, in the battlefield, it's often survival or victory. That's what you're after. And in the interrogation room, it's power. And there's the curse of power that the morally conscientious integrator understands, and that is that you could become, as you say, not just taking sexual advantage and dominant in that way, but just wipe someone's personality, moral personality, out. No, so it is a fear.
Nancy, I want to just before our next break, I want to just ask, slow us down here a bit. I assume, okay, there are some people who are pathological and might enjoy torturing someone. I suspect that for most of us, it's more like a matter of moral luck in our character. I mean, if we were put in the situation of having to do this, we might surprise ourselves, right, without having some deep pathology of how willing we were to be gradually led into being torturers. Do you think
that's
right
or wrong? Well, you're on a campus where the famous Zimbardo
exactly.
experiments were done that point out those tendencies in the best non-fascistic personalities. And the experiments had to be stopped because they show that many leaned terribly
right.
much in that direction. And same on the campus of Yale, the Milgram experiments about what you would do. But I would say again, we have this horrible record post Abu Ghraib, and currently in the middle, we still are at Guantanamo. There are a lot of interrogators out there that know where the lines are. And what I have discovered is even when they are doing it honorably, they are not doing it, but interrogating honorably, building intimacy and intimate rapport in order to exploit it, that feels like a moral violation when
you're
they
listening
step
to
out
philosophy.
Of the uniform.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing the ethics of torture with Nancy Sherman, author of The Untold War, Inside the Hearts, Minds, and Souls of Our Soldier.
Is torturing another person ever justified? Only in extreme cases? Is there really that huge a moral difference between physical torture and harsh interrogation techniques that fall short of physical injury?
The rights and wrongs of torture when Philosophy Talk continues.
Really have to hurt someone to get information they don't want to give? The ethics of torture is our topic today on Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry. This is the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. And I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Nancy Sherman, author of The Untold War, Inside the Hearts, Minds, and Souls of Our Soldiers.
So, Nancy, we want to move to some of the $64 questions. I mean, and the basic one, is the morality of torture a matter of absolutes? And if it isn't, Where should we draw the line? Is it immoral to torture an enemy soldier to get information that will save your own life or the life of your comrades? Is it different with a prisoner when there's some chance of information that will help us foil a terrorist plot that might kill thousands of people? And here's a question that interests me. Suppose I, for example, am sentenced to 10 years in prison and I would rather be tortured. I'd rather lose 10 fingernails quickly than spend 10 years in prison. Would it still be wrong to torture me? Well, how do we think of this?
The moral questions, Nancy.
Right. I side with my colleague David Luban, who's argued that there is an absolute here against torture, and that a lot of the ticking time bomb cases that we are accustomed to think about, especially as viewers of 24, and West Point cadets, by the way, view it, as well as some interrogators, are misleading, that they're hypotheticals that are very far-fetched and that actually aren't that realistic, and that the risk of to your own soul, that is the torturers, is too great, as well as the kind of decimation of the victim. On the case of consent, if you can.
Wait a minute. Slow down. This is too quick. You and David say, well, this ticking time bomb case, if it were realistic, it would cause me a problem. The ticking time bomb is, you know, there's a bomb about to go off in a short time. You got a guy who you believe might have some information, and if you get the information from him, you can stop the time bomb. And if you don't, because the threat is imminent and immediate and blah, blah, blah. And to say, well, no such case is realistic, that's just to take the easy route. I'm going to stick to the case.
Take the hard case.
Take the hard case and tell me why I shouldn't torture the ticking time bomb guy in the hard case. Not saying it's unrealistic.
Because you don't do that to an individual, even when the outcomes are enormously beneficial.
Really,
so I'm going to be a hard line. I'm going to be a hard line Kantian.
On what grounds? On what grounds are you going to be that? Look, a dirty bomb is going to go off in New York City in the middle of Manhattan, and hundreds of thousands of people are going to die, and there's going to be radiation. And we're going to let our moral niceties about not violating the will of a person whose will we should be resisting anyway? We're going to let our moral niceties stand in the way of stopping us from diminishing that guy's will to nothing? I mean, he has the will to kill. He has the will to kill.
First of all, accept the premises. I don't think we have that kind of information typically. And it's a very extreme case. We're often looking at how to give policy to young Americans who are in positions of enormous power. Once you have the permission to use torture in cases that you think are going to lead to very high value intelligence, you open up a card for everyone. So there's a utilitarian argument here too, of misuse and abuse of this kind of power in rampant ways. This is essentially what we saw going on in Abu Ghraib. Once you have high level chain of command decisions that if you think this is needed, go for it. We'll worry about the justifications later on, or we'll worry about how to get you off the hook later on. That's to me an enormous problem. We've already seen it doesn't work in many cases. I want to get back to one point that to me is absolutely critical and that is not in the imagination of the public, and I think it should be. When you don't torture and you do it by the books, which the manuals authorize you to do, and that is build rapport in order to exploit it, it still doesn't feel good for the torturer. We're so focused on torture here, we forget about the interrogator. For the interrogator, and I just want to raise a few kinds of examples. Having a detainee fall in love with you, playing on someone's infidelities, showing a detainee pictures of their loved ones that have been blown up by rival groups and softening them this way. Walking out of a detention cell and starting to laugh when you finally got someone to speak. Individuals who are in this kind of power, who have some kind of conscience, do not feel it's easy to be in that kind of position, even when they're getting very, very important information. Should not underestimate what it feels like to do it right.
Okay, but you're focused on the phenomenology. Okay, so let's grant the fact. Let's grant the fact of that phenomenology, that psychological, the way it strikes the interrogator. There's still a moral question. Suppose I could train my interrogators. You know, I coach baseball. Kids sometimes, you know, they get upset at themselves. I tell them, look, don't focus on your feelings about the situation. Focus on what you have to do to move the game forward. You make a mistake, don't go, oh, shoot, I made a mistake, and freeze up. Focus on what you have to do now to move the thing forward. And good baseball players eventually learn to do that. Good athletes eventually learn to do that. I suppose if I were trying to train interrogators, I'd say, focus not on your own psychology. Learn to focus. like the Stoic, I guess, would advise you, maybe not, I don't know, on what you have to do to move the situation forward. I mean, what would you say to that?
What I would say is bluntly, your feelings aren't just noise. They often are recorders of morally relevant phenomenon. And in the case of many interrogators, it's the morally relevant phenomenon is what can you do to someone else, and in many cases, in ways that really are within the constraints of legitimate interrogation to move it forward. So simply moving it forward, unbounded, unconstrained, isn't often an option for these guys. So I don't think it ought to be. Now, so there are moral constraints that are registering through the feelings. That we know.
In the current context, it's easy to be, focus on things that we know or at least believe happened during the Bush administration, which was a lot of people who weren't convicted of anything were subjected to various kinds of torture or near torture. And there was a lot of interest in getting testimony and, according to some, not too much interest in whether it's true. But setting that aside, aren't there cases that are not that unrealistic where a person has kind of opted out of the Kantian moral community? I mean, I think if I know that someone has kidnapped a child and left them somewhere to die, the Kantian in me says, I mean, or the little voice that talks to the Kantian in me would be saying to him, come on, this guy has opted out of the moral community. It's silly to treat him as if he was a rational being and entitled to dignity and respect when he's kidnapped a child and left him out in the woods. And that child is, as we speak, shivering, and you have to know where the child is.
Many of these examples, though, have the luxury of being philosopher's parlor talk. This isn't often what happens when you're teaching interrogators at a military academy or in a police academy or right there on the spot, as happened in Bagram and Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, what to do. They don't have that luxury. They have to have, just as our soldiers in the battlefield have, rules of engagement, like of the sort that General Stanley McChrystal is handing down, what you can and can't do in the general situations. Not every shot is going to be a strategic corporal's fielder's choice. And they've got to have these kinds of regulations or general constraints. And there are some, and we have cases of some, I believe his name is Colonel West, who made the choice on their own that they were going to torture because they felt they just simply had to, and take the consequences.
Yeah,
subject themselves to court-martial. Those are cases, or others go for torture warrants.
I take that.
Dershowitz has argued.
Nancy, I take your point. I want to defend philosopher's parlor games, as you call them. Philosopher's parlor games are intended to push our intuitions and our concepts to the breaking point, to see what they really support. And I agree, practical policies is one thing, and sort of digging at the deep sort of limits of our thinking about this is another thing, and I applaud philosophy for doing that. But on that note, I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been a scintillating conversation.
Well, thank you, and I still hold my philosopher status here, play many of your games, our games.
That's the spirit, yeah.
Okay. Our guest has been Nancy Sherman. She's professor of philosophy at Georgetown University, author of The Untold War, Inside the Hearts, Minds, and Souls of Our Soldiers. So, John, what's your closing final thought today?
Well, I'm very glad that someone of the philosophical caliber of Nancy Sherman has been drawn on by our military to teach at the Naval Academy, and that she's writing books about this. I think we're all the better for that. It's a very difficult topic, and I think one that there's a lot more philosophy to be said about it.
Oh, this conversation continues. This conversation continues, as always, on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org. As a matter of fact, it's already started, so go there and join it, theblog.philosophytalk.org, or go join our ever-growing Facebook community. It's a really happening spot in the Facebook universe.
There's so many ways to interact with us on Philosophy Talk. You can join the blog. Ken and I have been trying real hard to get blogs up for each program. You can download episodes of our program from our website as well. Now it's time to take Philosophy Talk to the movies.
To
today we're going to talk about the fascinating movie, A Serious Man, a recent movie by the Coen brothers, who are two of the weirdest guys making movies around. It reminds me of God Testing Job. It's about a guy named Larry Gopnik who's put to all these trials and tribulations and who raises the question, basically, why me? Why me?
We can get at the trials and tribulations without giving too much away just by citing the other characters. There's Danny, his son, coming up for his bar mitzvah, and also owing money to a very tough fellow high school student for marijuana. There's Arthur, his brother, who occupies enormous amounts of time in the only bathroom in their house with his sebaceous cyst. And also Judith, his wife, who's dumping Larry for a guy named Cy Abelman. He's utterly shocked, but somehow she manages to get the guilt into his court. He has let her do all the thinking about emotions and the marriage, and she now delivers her verdict that the marriage is over, it's all his fault, he should move out so that she and Cy Abelman can live together.
There's a wonderful scene in the movie where Cy and the wife, Judith, and Larry, they meet at a diner, and Cy and Judith just convince Larry that he should move out. They just logically convince him that, you know, the right thing to do is for him to move out, for him to be an adult.
Well, it makes eminent sense.
Things can't continue, is it?
Move out? Where would I go?
Well, for instance, the Jolly Roger is quite livable. It's not expensive. The rooms are eminently habitable.
This would allow you to visit the kids.
There's convenience in its favor. You've got a pool.
Wouldn't it make more sense for you to move in with Cy?
Larry, you are jesting.
So he's got this deep existential crisis.
But he thinks, I mean, the quest here is to get to his rabbi.
And there are three of them. There's the junior rabbi, the kind of older rabbi who's not the senior rabbi, and then this old senior rabbi who seems inaccessible, who's supposed to be really wise.
There's a great scene where he comes close to talking to the rabbi, but doesn't quite make it. He's sitting on the outside.
I've had quite a bit of tourists lately. Marital problems, professional, you name it. This is not a frivolous request. This is a serious... I've tried to be a serious man, you know? Please, I need help.
The secretary, after considerable pushing by Larry, finally goes and opens the door, and Larry sees the rabbi sitting behind his desk, a bearded, great-looking rabbi.
The rabbi is busy.
He didn't look busy.
He's thinking.
And I wondered, Ken, at that point, who did you identify with, Larry or the rabbi?
Yeah, well, it's like getting to God's waiting room, right? You finally get to God's waiting room, and you finally think you're going to get the guy who gives you the answer. And God's secretary says, sorry, God's busy. No time for you.
Turns out listening to the Jefferson Airplane might have been a better route for Larry to take, but I don't want to give away why that's so.
Yeah, well, it has a little bit to do with his son, but we won't give away that subplot. And I have to say, this movie is in some ways very surrealistic. It starts out with a really fantastical scene from 100 years earlier, right? And it ends with a fantastical scene, and which kind of hints that maybe doom is coming, that there is no answer. But the point of this movie, A Serious Man, I said I compare it to the Job story, because Larry is constantly asking the question, why me? What did I do? I've done nothing. He said, what did I do to deserve this? And the answer keeps coming back, well, you haven't done anything. That's his life, you know? It's like this deep existential crisis that he's going through, and at the bottom of it is, well, nothing. And lots of the movie is like that. There's lots of moral ambiguity, moral anguish, but with a light, humorous, sick touch.
The movie is A Serious Man, directed by Joel and Ethan Coen.
It's got to be one of the most philosophically interesting movies of the year.
Ken, it's fun talking about movies, but it's also fun to help our listeners talk about the philosophical problems that arise in their own life.
Yeah, if you've got a conundrum, you can send us an email at conundrums@philosophytalk.org. We won't promise to solve your problem, but we will give you lots of new ways to think about it.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2010.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Our directors of research are Daniel Elstein and Ben Hirsch. Leo Weiss is our webmaster.
Also thanks to Chris Hoff, Merle Kessler, Corey Goldman, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.